Today I'm reading from The Fear of Freedom by Erich Fromm. Originally published in 1941, this is Chapter 7, Freedom and Democracy, Part 1, The Illusion of Individuality. In the previous chapters, I have tried to show that certain factors in the modern industrial system in general, and its monopolistic phase in particular, make for the development of a personality which feels powerless and alone, anxious and insecure. I have discussed the specific conditions in Germany which make part of her population fertile soil for an ideology and political practice that appeal to what I have described as the authoritarian character. But what about ourselves? Is our own democracy threatened only by fascism beyond the Atlantic, or by the fifth column in our own ranks? If that were the case, the situation would be serious but not critical. But although foreign and international threats of fascism must be taken seriously, there is no greater mistake and no graver danger than not to see that in our own society we are faced with the same phenomenon that is fertile soil for the rise of fascism anywhere: the insignificance and powerlessness of the individual. This statement challenges the conventional belief that by freeing the individual from all external restraints, modern democracy has achieved true individualism. We are proud that we are not subject to any external authority, that we are free to express our thoughts and feelings, and we take it for granted that this freedom almost automatically guarantees our individuality. The right to express our thoughts, however, means something only if we are able to have thoughts of our own. Freedom from external authority is a lasting gain only if the inner psychological conditions are such that we are able to establish our own individuality. Have we achieved that aim, or are we at least approaching it? This book deals with the human factor. Its task, therefore, is to analyze this very question critically. In doing so, we take up threads that were dropped in earlier chapters. In discussing the two aspects of freedom for modern man, we have pointed out the economic conditions that make for increasing isolation and powerlessness of the individual in our era. In discussing the psychological results, we have shown that this powerlessness leads either to the kind of escape that we find in the authoritarian character, or else to a compulsive conforming, in the process of which the isolated individual becomes an automaton, loses his self, and yet at the same time consciously conceives of himself as free and subject only to himself. It is important to consider how our culture fosters this tendency to conform, even though there is space for only a few outstanding examples. The suppression of spontaneous feelings, and thereby of the development of genuine individuality, starts very early, as a matter of fact, with the earliest training of a child. This is not to say that training must inevitably lead to suppression of spontaneity if the real aim of education is to further the inner independence and individuality of the child, its growth and integrity. The restrictions which such a kind of education may have to impose upon the growing child are only transitory measures that really support the process of growth and expansion. In our culture, however, education too often results in the elimination of spontaneity and in the substitution of original psychic acts by superimposed feelings, thoughts, and wishes. By original, I don't mean, let me repeat, that an idea has not been thought before by somebody else, but that it originates in the individual and that it is the result of his own activity, and in this sense is his thought. To choose one illustration somewhat arbitrarily, one of the earliest suppressions of feelings concerns hostility and dislike. To start with, most children have a certain measure of hostility and rebelliousness as a result of their conflicts with a surrounding world that tends to block their expansiveness and to which, as the weaker opponent, they usually have to yield. It is one of the essential aims of the educational process to eliminate this antagonistic reaction. The methods are different. They vary from threats and punishments, which frighten the child, to the subtler methods of bribery or, quote, explanations, which confuse the child and make him give up his hostility. The child starts with giving up the expression of his feeling and eventually gives up the very feeling itself. Together with that, he is taught to suppress the awareness of hostility and insincerity in others. Sometimes this is not entirely easy, since children have a capacity for noticing such negative qualities in others without being so easily deceived by words as adults usually are. They still dislike somebody, quote, for no good reason, except the very good one that they feel the hostility or insincerity radiating from that person. This reaction is soon discouraged. It does not take long for the child to reach the, quote, maturity of the adult and to lose the sense of discrimination between a decent person and a scoundrel, as long as the latter has not committed some flagrant act. On the other hand, early in his education, the child is taught to have feelings that are not at all his. Particularly, he is taught to like people, to be uncritically friendly to them, and to smile. What education may not have accomplished is usually done by social pressure in later life. If you don't smile, you're judged lacking in a pleasing personality. And you need to have a pleasing personality if you want to sell your services, whether as a waitress, a salesman, or a physician. Only those at the bottom of the social pyramid who sell nothing but their physical labor, and those at the very top do not need to be particularly pleasant. Friendliness, cheerfulness, and everything that a smile is supposed to express become automatic responses which one turns on and off like an electric switch. To be sure, in many instances, the person is aware of merely making a gesture. In most cases, however, he loses that awareness and thereby the ability to discriminate between the pseudo-feeling and spontaneous friendliness. It's not only hostility that is directly suppressed and friendliness that is killed by superimposing its counterfeit. A wide range of spontaneous emotions are suppressed and replaced by pseudo-feelings. Freud has taken one such suppression and put it at the center of his whole system, namely the suppression of sex. Although I believe that the discouragement of sexual joy is not the only important suppression of spontaneous reactions, but one of many, certainly its importance is not to be underrated. Its results are obvious in cases of sexual inhibitions, and also in those where sex assumes a compulsive quality and is consumed like liquor or a drug, which has no particular taste but makes you forget yourself. Regardless of the one or the other effect, their suppression, because of the intensity of sexual desires, not only affects the sexual sphere, but also weakens the person's courage for spontaneous expression in all other spheres. In our society, emotions in general are discouraged. While there can be no doubt that any creative thinking, as well as any other creative activity, is inseparably linked with emotion, it has become an ideal to think and to live without emotions. To be emotional has become synonymous with being unsound or unbalanced. By the acceptance of this standard, the individual has become greatly weakened. His thinking is impoverished and flattened. On the other hand, since emotions cannot be completely killed, they must have their existence totally apart from the intellectual side of the personality. The result is the cheap and insecure sentimentality with which movies and popular songs feed millions of emotion-starved customers. There is one tabooed emotion that I want to mention in particular because its suppression touches deeply on the roots of personality, the sense of tragedy. As we saw in an earlier chapter, the awareness of death and of the tragic aspect of life, whether dim or clear, is one of the basic characteristics of man. Each culture has its own way of coping with the problem of death. For those societies in which the process of individuation has progressed but little, the end of individual existence is less of a problem, since the experience of individual existence itself is less developed. Death is not yet conceived as being basically different from life. Cultures in which we find a higher development of individuation have treated death according to their social and psychological structure. The Greeks put all emphasis on life and pictured death as nothing but a shadowy and dreary continuation of life. The Egyptians based their hopes on a belief of the indestructibility of the human body, at least of those whose power during life was indestructible. The Jews admitted the fact of death realistically and were able to reconcile themselves with the idea of the destruction of individual life by the vision of a state of happiness and justice ultimately to be reached by mankind in this world. Christianity has made death unreal and tried to comfort the unhappy individual by promises of a life after death. Our own era simply denies death, and with it one fundamental aspect of life. Instead of allowing the awareness of death and suffering to become one of the strongest incentives for life, the basis for human solidarity, and an experience without which joy and enthusiasm lack intensity and depth, the individual is forced to repress it. But, as is always the case with repression, by being removed from sight, the repressed elements do not cease to exist. Thus, the fear of death lives an illegitimate existence among us. It remains alive in spite of the attempt to deny it, but being repressed, it remains sterile. It is one source of the flatness of our experiences, of the restlessness pervading life, and it explains, I would venture to say, the exorbitant amount of money this nation pays for its funerals. In the process of tabooing emotions, modern psychiatry plays an ambiguous role. On the one hand, its greatest representative, Freud, has broken through the fiction of the rational, purposeful character of the human mind and opened a path which allows a view into the abyss of human passions. On the other hand, psychiatry, enriched by these very achievements of Freud, has made itself an instrument of the general trends in the manipulation of personality. Many psychiatrists, including psychoanalysts, have painted the picture of a normal personality which is never too sad, too angry, or too excited. They use words like infantile or neurotic to denounce traits or types of personalities that do not conform with the conventional pattern of a normal individual. This kind of influence is in a way more dangerous than the older and franker forms of name-calling. Then, the individual knew at least that there was some person or some doctrine which criticized him, and he could fight back. But who can fight back at, quote, science? The same distortion happens to original thinking as happens to feelings and emotions. From the very start of education, original thinking is discouraged, and ready-made thoughts are put into people's heads. How this is done with young children is easy enough to see. They are filled with curiosity about the world. They want to grasp it physically as well as intellectually. They want to know the truth, since that is the safest way to orient themselves in a strange and powerful world. Instead, they are not taken seriously, and it does not matter whether this attitude takes the form of open disrespect or of the subtle condescension which is usual towards all those who have no power, such as children, aged or sick people. Although this treatment by itself offers strong discouragement to independent thinking, there is a worse handicap. The insincerity, often unintentional, which is typical of the average adult's behavior towards a child. This insincerity consists partly in the fictitious picture of the world which the child is given. It is about as useful as instructions concerning life in the Arctic would be to someone who has asked how to prepare for an expedition to the Sahara Desert. Besides this general misrepresentation of the world, there are many specific lies that tend to conceal facts which, for various personal reasons, adults do not want the children to know. From a bad temper, which is rationalized as justified dissatisfaction with the child's behavior, to concealment of the parents' sexual activities and their quarrels, the child is, quote, not supposed to know, and his inquiries are met with hostile or polite discouragement. The child thus prepared enters school, and perhaps college. I want to mention briefly some of the educational methods used today, which in effect further discourage original thinking. One is the emphasis on the knowledge of facts, or I should rather say, on information. The pathetic superstition prevails that by knowing more and more facts, one arrives at knowledge of reality. Hundreds of scattered and unrelated facts are dumped into the heads of students. Their time and energy are taken up by learning more and more facts so that there is little left for thinking. To be sure, thinking without a knowledge of facts remains empty and fictitious, but information alone can be just as much of an obstacle to thinking as the lack of it. Another closely related way of discouraging original thinking is to regard all truth as relative. Truth is made out to be a metaphysical concept, and if anyone speaks about wanting to discover the truth, he is thought backward by the progressive thinkers of the age. Truth is declared to be an entirely subjective matter, almost a matter of taste. Scientific endeavor must be detached from subjective factors, and its aim is to look at the world without passion and interest. The scientist has to approach facts with sterilized hands as a surgeon approaches his patient. The result of this relativism, which often presents itself by the name of empiricism or positivism, or which recommends itself by its concern for the correct usage of words, is that thinking loses its essential stimulus, the wishes and interests of the person who thinks. Instead, it becomes a machine to register quote-unquote facts. Actually, just as thinking in general has developed out of the need for the mastery of material life, so the quest for truth is rooted in the interests and needs of individuals and social groups. Without such interest, the stimulus for seeking the truth would be lacking. There are always groups whose interest is furthered by truth, and their representatives have been the pioneers of human thought. There are other groups whose interests are furthered by concealing truth. Only in the latter case does interest prove harmful to the cause of truth. The problem, therefore, is not that there is an interest at stake, but which kind of interest is at stake. I might say that inasmuch as there is some longing for the truth in every human being, it is because every human being has some need for it. This holds true in the first place with regard to a person's orientation in the outer world, and it holds especially true for the child. As a child, every human being passes through a state of powerlessness, and truth is one of the strongest weapons of those who have no power. But the truth is in the individual's interest not only with regard to his orientation in the outer world. His own strength depends to a great extent on his knowing the truth about himself. Illusions about oneself can become crutches useful to those who are not able to walk alone, but they increase a person's weakness. The individual's greatest strength is based on the maximum of integration of his personality, and that means also on the maximum of transparency to himself. Know thyself is one of the fundamental commands that aim at human strength and happiness. In addition to the factors just mentioned, there are others which actively tend to confuse whatever is left out of the capacity for original thinking in the average adult. With regard to all basic questions of individual and social life, with regard to psychological, economic, political, and moral problems, a great sector of our culture has just one function: to befog the issues. One kind of smokescreen is the assertion that the problems are too complicated for the average individual to grasp. On the contrary, it would seem that many of the basic issues of individual and social life are very simple. So simple, in fact, that everyone should be expected to understand them. To let them appear to be so enormously complicated that only a specialist can understand them, and he only in his own limited field, and often intentionally, tends to discourage people from trusting their own capacity to think about those problems that really matter. The individual feels so helplessly caught in a chaotic mess of data, and with pathetic patience waits until the specialists have found out what to do and where to go. The result of this kind of influence is twofold. One is the skepticism and cynicism towards everything which is said or printed, while the other is a childish belief in anything that a person is told with authority. This combination of cynicism and naivete is very typical of the modern individual. Its essential result is to discourage him from doing his own thinking and deciding. Another way of paralyzing the ability to think critically is the destruction of any kind of structuralized picture of the world. Facts lose the specific quality which they can have only as parts of a structuralized whole, and remain merely an abstract, quantitative meaning. Each fact is just another fact, and all that matters is whether we know more or less. Radio, moving pictures, and newspapers have a devastating effect on this score. The announcement of the bombing of a city and the death of hundreds of people is shamelessly followed or interrupted by an advertisement for soap or wine. The same speaker with the same suggestive, ingratiating, and authoritative voice, which he has just used to impress you with the seriousness of the political situation, impresses now upon his audience the merit of the particular brand of soap which pays for the news broadcast. Newsreels let pictures of torpedoed ships be followed by those of a fashion show. Newspapers tell us the trite thoughts or breakfast habits of a debutante with the same space and seriousness they use for reporting events of scientific or artistic importance. Because of all of this, we cease to be genuinely related to what we hear. We cease to be excited, our emotions and our critical judgments become hampered, and eventually our attitude to what is going on in the world assumes a quality of flatness and indifference. In the name of, quote, freedom, life loses all structure. It is composed of many little pieces, each separate from the other and lacking any sense as a whole. The individual is left alone with these pieces like a child with a puzzle. The difference, however, is that the child knows what a house is and therefore can recognize the parts of the house and the little pieces he is playing with, whereas the adult does not see the meaning of the whole, the pieces of which come into his hands. He is bewildered and afraid and just goes on gazing at his little meaningless pieces. What has been said about the lack of originality in feeling and thinking holds true also of the act of willing. To recognize this is particularly difficult. Modern man seems, if anything, to have too many wishes, and his only problem seems to be that, although he knows what he wants, he cannot have it. All our energy is spent for the purpose of getting what we want, and most people never question the premise of this activity, that they know their true wants. They do not stop to think whether the aims they are pursuing are something they themselves want. In school, they want to have good marks, as adults want to be more and more successful, to make money, to have more prestige, to buy a better car, to go places, and so on. Yet when they do stop to think in the middle of all this frantic activity, this question may come to their minds. If I do get this new job, if I get this better car, if I can take this trip, what then? What is the use of it all? Is it really I who wants all of this? Am I not running after some goal which is supposed to make me happy and which eludes me as soon as I have reached it? These questions, when they arrive, are frightening, for they question the very basis on which man's whole activity is built, his knowledge of what he wants. People tend, therefore, to get rid as soon as possible of these disturbing thoughts. They feel that they have been bothered by these questions because they were tired or depressed, and they go on in the pursuit of the aims which they believe are their own. Yet all this bespeaks a dim realization of the truth that modern man lives under the illusion that he knows what he wants, while he actually wants what he is supposed to want. In order to accept this, it is necessary to realize that to know what one really wants is not comparatively easy, as most people think, but one of the most difficult problems any human being has to solve. It is a task we frantically try to avoid by accepting ready-made goals as though they were our own. Modern man is ready to take great risks when he tries to achieve the aims which are supposed to be his, but he is deeply afraid of taking the risk and the responsibility of giving himself his own aims. Intense activity is often mistaken for evidence of self-determined action, although we know that it may well be no more than spontaneous than the behavior of an actor or a person hypnotized. When the general plot of the play is handed out, each actor can act vigorously the role he is assigned and even make up his lines and certain details of the action by himself. Yet he is only playing a role that has been handed over to him. The particular difficulty in recognizing to what extent our wishes and our thoughts and feelings as well are not really our own, but put into us from outside, is closely linked up with the problem of authority and freedom. In the course of modern history, the authority of the church has been replaced by that of the state by that of conscience, and in our era, the latter has been replaced by the anonymous authority of common sense and public opinion as instruments of conformity. Because we have freed ourselves of the older overt forms of authority, we do not see that we have become the prey of a new kind of authority. We have become automatons who live under the illusion of being self-willing individuals. This illusion helps the individual to remain unaware of his insecurity, but this is all the help such an illusion can give. Basically, the self of the individual is weakened, so he feels powerless and extremely insecure. He lives in a world in which he has lost genuine relatedness, in which everybody and everything has become instrumentalized, where he has become a part of the machine that his hands have built. He thinks, feels, and wills what he believes he is supposed to think, feel, and will. In this very process, he loses his self, upon which all genuine security of a free individual must be built. The loss of the self has increased the necessity to conform, for it results in a profound doubt of one's own identity. If I am nothing but what I believe I am supposed to be, who am I? We have shown how the doubt about one's own self started with the breakdown of the medieval order, in which the individual had had an unquestionable place in a fixed order. The identity of the individual has been a major problem of modern philosophy since Descartes. Today we take for granted that we are we. Yet the doubt about ourselves still exists, or has even grown. In his plays, Pirandello has given expression to this feeling of modern man. He starts with the question, who am I? What proof have I for my own identity other than the continuation of my physical self? His answer is not like Descartes, the affirmation of the individual self, but its denial. I have no identity. There is no self, excepting the one which is a reflex of what others expect me to be. I am, quote, as you desire me. This loss of identity then makes it still more imperative to conform. It means that one can be sure of oneself only if one lives to the expectations of others. If we do not live up to this picture, we not only risk disapproval and increased isolation, but we risk losing the identity of our personality, which means jeopardizing sanity. By conforming with the expectations of others, by not being different, these doubts about one's own identity are silenced, and a certain security is gained. However, the price paid is high. Giving up spontaneity and individuality results in a thwarting of life. Psychologically, the automaton, while being alive biologically, is dead emotionally and mentally. While he goes through the motions of living, his life runs through his hands like sand. Being a front of satisfaction and optimism, modern man is deeply unhappy. As a matter of fact, he is on the verge of desperation. He desperately clings to the notion of individuality. He wants to be different, and he has no greater recommendation of anything than that, quote, it is different. We are informed of the individual name of the railroad clerk we buy our tickets from. Handbags, playing cards, and portable radios are personalized by having the initials of the owner put on them. All this indicates the hunger for difference, and yet these are almost the last vestiges of individuality that are left. Modern man is starved for life. But since being an automaton, he cannot experience life in the sense of spontaneous activity, he takes as surrogate any kind of excitement and thrill. The thrill of drinking, of sports, of vicariously living the excitements of fictitious persons on the screen. What then is the meaning of freedom for modern man? He has become free from the external bonds that would prevent him from doing and thinking as he sees fit. He would be free to act according to his own will, if he knew what he wanted, thought, and felt. But he does not know. He conforms to anonymous authorities and adopts a self which is not his. The more he does this, the more powerless he feels, the more is he forced to conform. In spite of a veneer of optimism and initiative, modern man is overcome by a profound feeling of powerlessness which makes him gaze towards approaching catastrophes as though he were paralyzed. Looked at superficially, people appear to function well enough in economic and social life. Yet it would be dangerous to overlook the deep-seated unhappiness behind the comforting veneer. If life loses its meaning because it is not lived, man becomes desperate. People do not die quietly from physical starvation. They do not die quietly from psychic starvation either. If we look only at the economic needs as far as the normal person is concerned, if we do not see the unconscious suffering of the average automatized person, then we fail to see the danger that threatens our culture from its human basis. The readiness to accept any ideology and any leader, if only he promises excitement and offers a political structure and symbols which allegedly give meaning and order to an individual's life. The despair of the human automaton is fertile soil for the political purposes of fascism. End of chapter 7, part 1. The illusion of individuality.